We turn now, please, tonight with your presence here to be with us as we turn our thoughts to the Lord's Word. The fact that you are here, the fact that you have such a good crowd on a Monday night speaks of your interest, your concern, and we're certainly glad to see that. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak with you as we're doing tonight. Let me turn your thoughts to begin with in tonight's lesson with two passages in the Old and New Testament. And these have to do with what we've been talking about that we'll briefly summarize until we go into our study tonight. Romans 16 tells us in verse 25 of the mystery which was kept secret since the foundation of the world, or since the world began. So that was a secret, so to speak, not fully revealed, but revealed only in part, since the foundation of this world. And then we go still farther. We turn to 1 Peter chapter 1. Here in verse 19, he speaks of the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot, who really was ordained before the foundation of the world. So what we're speaking about in our studies this week have to do with things that began before this world came to being, before time began, before this earth was established. It has to do with the eternity that God himself is in and controls and will control, as I've already said, as long as time lasts. There's no time in eternity. It goes on and on and on. As far as we know, it had no beginning. God is, and so that's sufficient to say, God is. He has been, he will be. And when we talk about God in that sense, we understand we're speaking about a divine being that certainly is all-powerful, all-knowing, and also all-providing, as we have the hope as Christians that he will be. Well, since these two passages I've just read to you have to do with understanding that there has been something since time immemorial and before that time as to God's plan, his purpose throughout the ages. And that's our purpose during this series of meetings, to speak about those things God has outlined for us, given us a beautiful, beautiful picture of what he had in mind and continues to give us pictures throughout the scriptures. And as we begin our study Sunday morning, we talked about the existence of God. We talked about his forming of this earth and all things having to do with it, bringing into being time and material things as well as human life. We notice also that after the beginning shortly, man, even though he was put in a place of peace and paradise, a place where everything was provided and beauty was there, there was no problem, no problem at all, no sin, nothing that would interrupt the pleasure and joy of mankind, man nonetheless stumbled and fell. Remember the story, of course, in the Garden of Eden. And then we notice that Adam and Eve had two sons. One committed murder unto the other son. And then they were given a third son. Also we notice, too, they had sons and daughters after that. And the world began to be populated to the point at which in Genesis chapter 6 we find every thought and imagination of man's heart was only evil continually. So God said, I'll destroy the man which I have created. So God was in his rights, and by all rights should have, destroyed everything because we were sinners and have no hope of life eternal. We had no reason to have hope for that because mankind was sin. Now you were not, of course, because you were not there. The point is, Adam and Eve, our forefathers, did engage in sin, and as a consequence of that sin, we inherit not their sin. They sinned. We don't inherit their sin, but we inherit the consequence of their sin. And that, of course, is death. So we come into the world alive, we come into the world live for a few years, and then we pass on to death with the hope of a resurrection hereafter that the New Testament tells us about. In the meantime, though, the Bible tells us God decided to destroy this world with the exception that he saw one man, Noah, who was righteous and who would follow him and do his will. And so through Noah, he promised the world a place to continue if they would build an ark, listen to his word, and would endure the flood he was to sin. He sent the flood, of course, and then man in that flood was able to be revived, mankind was, with eight souls who came out of it to inhabit a brand new, clean, pure world. But as has been the case, and this is a sad thing, as has been the case from the very beginning, as is the situation now, has been all the time in between, man just will not listen to God. He allowed them to have one generation where they follow him and then sin. He has to bring them up again, and he does. And they live for one generation, fall again. And that's one reason why it's so important today that we're concerned about the generation which is going to follow those of us who are older, to maintain the truth and keep it prevailed as God intended for it to be for generations yet to come. And that's where we're studying as we are, trying to prepare ourselves to have a generation after us that will follow on to keep the Lord's work and his torch burning brightly. And so God saw fit eventually then, after the time of the flood, and after the people rebelled by building the Tower of Babel, which is where the languages were confused, God punished that sin by having languages confused and men scattered throughout the world. We found then that God saw fit to maintain his blessings over mankind by selecting another person. Now, he does not select people by means of saying, I want you, I want you, I want you, regardless of their condition. But God has always selected people who listen to and follow him to do his will. He selected Noah because Noah walked with God. Now he selects another man who will walk with God. This man's name is Abraham. The Bible tells us in Genesis chapter 12 that Abraham was to leave where he was and go to a new place to get away from the idols, the images, and the sin that was there, to a new place he did not know about, but that God told him to go to. Hebrews chapter 11 tells us about that. Begin with verse 8. By faith Abraham, when he was called of God to go to a place where he should, after receive for inheritance, obeyed. He went out not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles or tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. So Abraham now has a commission from God to go to this new land and wait there for the blessings I'm going to give you, and to you the entire world will be blessed. Now we read this even farther in the book of Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, 2, and 3, when Abraham is told by God, you will become a great nation, your descendants will, and from this nation will emerge one who will be the Savior of the world. Here's the first promise I know of the coming of the Messiah written to mankind. As we read a moment ago, God had this in his mind before the world began. He knew men was going to sin. He knew what men would do. He understood all that. He provided before man was ever created to save man to the sending of his son. That was before the world began. So God now begins to tell Abraham and us through Abraham of the coming of the Messiah, that we might through him be saved. Abraham then traveled to that new land where he was destined to go. And the Bible tells us that as Abraham was there, he began to be old in age. In fact, he was old enough to where God had told him, as he got older and older and older, that you're going to have a son. He didn't have a son. The son didn't come. His wife could not bear a son. Until finally he was 86 years old. And Sarah came to Abraham and she said, in effect, we don't have a son. God promised us a son. And Abraham said, in effect, if I don't have a son, how can I have this heir that's going to come to save the world? And notice, if you would, there were two people to start with, and then man sinned. Then there were only seven people who would listen to Noah. Eight souls went to the ark, and the world was saved through them. God has always dealt with a small number. He has the ability and has over and over and over again caused his people to rise in number, but usually it's a small group that will be faithful and dedicated to him. And that same true is today as well. So we find also again now, as we turn to Abraham's life, it was almost impossible now for God to keep his promise. Time and time and time again we have seen and will see that God is not going to be defeated. When God says something, it will be precisely as he says, even though it may not be when we think it should be, or as we think it should be, or as expected to be. God's going to always come through with flying colors. And so when Abraham was 86 years old, Sarah said, in effect, take my handmaid, she'll be your wife, and have a child through him. The point is here that Sarah decided she'd use Hagar as a go-between and help God out by having a child through a handmaid. Well, let me suggest to you that didn't work. and never will work for us to try to help God out. He doesn't need our help. He uses our help. He wants us to serve Him, and in many, many times works through us. He doesn't have to have us, and we don't need to tell God what He ought to do and how He ought to do it. And so often we fail when we follow that procedure. We will probably talk about that Thursday and Friday night, much, much more detail than we will between now and then. So you can look for that later on this week. Well, Hagar had a child. This was 14 years before Abraham became 100 years old. In the meantime, God told him very plainly, this is not to be your heir. And when Abraham was 99 years old, God appeared to Sarah and Abraham again, and he said, next year at this time, you will have that son I promised you. They laughed. In fact, I understand from Hebrew the word Isaac means he laughed. And that's what Abraham and Sarah did. In the meantime, though, the next year, sure enough, Sarah had the son. The son was named Isaac at 100 years old. You see, God came through with his promise. But one thing we need to know also is that God allowed Abraham and those who were with him to exist where they were existing, and then eventually he was going to have something happen to them to get them away from the evil that was surrounding them until the time came for them to inherit the promised land, which also was to be the home of that nation he was to form through Isaac. In the meantime, Isaac grows and prospers, and the Bible tells us very plainly that Isaac now is sought for a wife. They go over to where Abraham was from, that he might not marry those who were the Gentiles around him, might go back to his family and bring a wife from back from there. And of course, that's precisely what he did. And so Isaac now has a wife. And this wife has two sons. The sons are Jacob and Esau, as you might remember in your power studies in the past. And so these two sons grow and they prosper to the point at which, however, it becomes time now for the line of descent to pass on from Abraham to Isaac to one of the two sons. Now, which one of those should it be? Well, according to the practice of the day and according to the procedure that had been going on from time immemorial, the oldest son would inherit. And this case was true now. We find that Esau should have inherited the birthright and carried on that promise. But Esau was hungry one day after he'd come back from hunting, and he didn't see fit to appreciate what was his to be. So he said, I'll sell you my birthright to Jacob, who took some pottage, that is, soup in a pot. And as Jacob gave him that to eat, then Jacob bought the birthright from Esau. He didn't appreciate it. He didn't care for it like he should have. He didn't value what was his to inherit that long, long line from Adam, and which was to continue, as we will find, unto the coming of Jesus Christ. He was in line for that. It was his to enjoy, his to have, and the pleasure and joy of being in God's line would have been his, but he didn't value it. He sold it. And so we know, of course, from the Bible story, that there was enmity then between Esau and Jacob. Jacob now has to flee from Esau because Esau is very angry with him for this. And Jacob flees over to a land where he gets his wife. Now his wife, of course, is from the same people that Abraham came from. So again, we keep that same line going. But on the other hand, they come from where we know of as Baghdad today, in that area, back over to around Jerusalem is. And that's where we find that line of defense continuing. We find then that Esau also began to marry. And who Esau married, strangely enough, was one of the daughters from Hagar, who had been Sarah's handmaiden, as you remember. In the meantime, we notice as we look back at the story that Hagar, who was the handmaiden of Sarah, was put away from them because of jealousy. And God saw fit through Abraham to bless this line of descent, because there was Abraham's son, and God was concerned about Abraham, and Abraham was concerned about that son he had. And so God allowed him also to prosper. So there were 12 sons born to Ishmael. And these 12 sons became what we know of today as the Arabs. And of course, in time to come, they become what we know of today as the Muslims, because of religion they had developed and maintained until our present day. Now that was 4,000 years ago. And to this very day, those people still exist, and there's still that enmity existing between the descendants of Ishmael on one hand and Isaac on the other hand. Because from the Isaac emerged the Israelites. Now that problem, which existed 4,000 years ago, with the lack of judgment that Sarah had in trying to help out God, that same problem has been around for 4,000 years. And I don't care what president of our nation tries to solve that problem, they've never been able to, and I don't foresee them ever solving that problem. It still exists. It's getting worse and worse throughout the world as the Muslims grow in number and influence and danger and aggression. So we notice that when a man sins, when a person does what's wrong, the consequence can be very, very long-lasting as it is here. In the meantime, again, we find that the descendants of Ishmael are those who become this great nation emerging from 12 sons. Now, we turn back to Jacob for a moment. Jacob now is the son, the proper son, of Isaac and Rebekah. And Jacob now has a wife that he has obtained over in this land where he went to get her Abraham from to begin with. And you know the story of how he intended to have Rachel as his wife, but he was tricked too, as he tricked his brother Esau. So he's tricked as well, so the wife he thought he was going to have is not the wife he got. We find that her sister was substituted the first night. He realized the mistake that had been made, and so he worked 7 more years for her until the time came at which he went back toward the land he was from. And in doing so, we have these two wives, Leah and Rachel, and then their two handmaidens that go with him back over there. Now, they also have 12 sons and one daughter. These 12 sons become now the children of Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel, and that's the reason in the Testament, Old Testament as well, we speak about Israel, really, as being the descendants of Jacob, and they were. His name since was changed. So when you read about Israel, you can trace the line back to Jacob, and of course to Isaac, to Abraham, and back to Adam. Now that's the two divisions we find here. One on one hand, the Muslims came from the 12 sons of Ishmael, and the 12 sons of Jacob came from God's line of descent to become what we know of as Israel. Later on, the word Jew is used to refer to them. Let's see if we can understand a little bit further as we go down the line of descent by looking at this chain on the screen. See if I can describe this a little bit. We start at Adam, who died at 130 years old. And we come down that line for 10 generations. This brings us up to a time of about 1656 years after the creation, which is about 2353 B.C. And then the next 10 generations we've already talked about, coming down to the man whose name was Terah, the 20th generation. The 21st generation was Abraham. Abraham now, he married his half-sister, who was Sarah. They have a son named Isaac, who in turn marries Rebecca, who is a descendant from Nahor, Haran, who were his brothers back over in the land he came from near Baghdad. In the meantime now, as we'll notice a little further, the sons of Isaac and Rebecca are Esau and Jacob. Esau now is the one who is lost in line of descent because he didn't value his birthright. Jacob, in the meantime, did value that line of descent. He treasured it, and he married and had 12 sons. These 12 sons become known as the tribes of Israel, or the tribes that come from Jacob. This is basically where we have come in our study thus far tonight. As we continue on, I want you to notice that Abraham now has passed in death. Isaac has passed in death. And Jacob is on the scene now as an old man. And he has, at this particular time, he has 11 sons. And the 12th son is not yet born. In the meantime, the 11th son, whose name is Joseph, is one that was 17 years old. He was not liked at all by his brothers. And the reason why is because they were jealous of him. Now, he was the only son at this time born to the real wife, the desired wife, the wife that was intended to be to Jacob. And he was favored by his father. The father made him a beautiful robe of mixed colors. And one day when the brothers were out away from home, and Jacob and Joseph were sent to find them and to visit with them, they saw him coming, and they decided that they would kill him. They were so jealous of him, they would kill him. In the meantime, we find that instead of killing him, they threw him into a cave temporarily, and there were some Midianites who came by the way on their trip into Egypt. And they decided they would sell their brother instead of killing him and get rid of him that way. So they sold him to the Midianites and took him into Egypt. So now we find this young man, 17 years old, sold as a slave by his own brothers, taken into Egypt, where he there becomes a slave again as he becomes a servant of Potiphar, who's one of the king's right-hand men. Well, in the meantime, he is very faithful, very dedicated to God. He does what God tells him to do. He treasures and respects God in every way and tries to live the kind of life that he was raised to live, the kind of life of honesty and truthfulness and serve God, as opposed to being like his brothers were, like others of the world around him were. But he was so well-liked and so favored, this young man was, that Potiphar's wife decided that she would entice Joseph to have sexual relations with her. And she attempted this, but he refused. He continued to refuse her advances to the point at which she was so aggravated, she said, in effect, these are my words now, not the Bible's words, in effect, since I can't have what I want, I'm going to destroy him. And that's what she did. She laid a plot whereby it would appear that he had attacked her as opposed to her trying to get to him. And when she yelled out, she held a piece of his cloth in her hands. The servants came in, saw what had happened. They took her word for it that Joseph had attacked their mistress. And in doing so, he was thrown into prison. So we have this young man now who was 17 years old, who now has gained experience. He was well favored. Everything in the household was his except for his owner's wife. And he had been very, very faithful, but now he is put in prison, and he stays in prison for 2 years. Now, that seems to be something that you wouldn't desire at all, and of course none of us would, but it seems almost unjust, doesn't it? Here's a man who wants to do what's right. He wants to serve God. He has committed no sin. He's been right all the time. He's lied on. And he suffers the consequence of being thrown in jail because of it. It doesn't look right. Sometimes when you look at the Bible, you think, well, now, why did God let that happen? And sometimes in our lives, too, people all along think in terms of, why did God let me get in this fix? Why didn't God pull me out of this? God could have. Why did he do it? Sometimes people think that way. But don't think that way. Because as you'll notice in the life of Joseph, his thinking was not that way at all. He still respected God and served God and loved God to the point at which he was honest. He was faithful, he was trustworthy, so that the master of the jail, of the prison, favored him and put him over all that was in the prison. Well, in the meantime, there were two there who had been thrown in prison from Pharaoh, who was a baker and a butler. Now, these two had fallen in disfavor to the point at which they had been in prison now. They were out of Pharaoh's sight and out of his mind, and they were there for some period of time. They believed they had a dream, each of them did, and these dreams had to do with something they didn't understand. And they happened to mention it to Joseph. And Joseph was able to talk to them about it and to tell them, of course, that God could interpret dreams. And so one of them told Joseph what his dream was. In 3 days, he said, there is going to be a situation happen. And this is going to be that in 3 days you're going to be raised back up to the position you had before, and once again you'll serve Pharaoh's cup as you did as a butler before. And the baker saw that was so well pleased, decided he would approach Joseph and say, explain to me my dream. He did. And Joseph said, in 3 days, the dream you had was the birds plucking food out of your basket. He said, that simply means in 3 days you're going to be hanged, your head will be cut off, and the birds will come and eat your flesh. Not very pleasant. So one had a very pleasant prediction, the other very, very unpleasant prediction. But sure enough, in 3 days, that's exactly what happened. Pharaoh raised him back up again. He allowed the butler once again to serve him with his cup, and he hanged the baker. Well, at that particular time, when this had been interpreted by Joseph, Joseph told the butler, when you go back to Pharaoh, you let him know that I'm in here, unjust, I shouldn't be here. Remind him of me. But of course, that wasn't done. The butler forgot about it. He had what he wanted, and sometimes people act that way too. They have what they wanted, they get what's pleasing to them, they think about me, and they don't think about the responsibility of others around them. But 2 years later, Pharaoh himself dreamed a dream as well. And this dream was such that he was not able to understand it, and the dream was told. And then the butler said, oh, I remember my fault this day. He said, when I was back in prison before I was brought up before you again to serve your cup once more, there was a man down there who interpreted my dream, and the other man's dream too. And it came about just exactly like that man said that it would. And so they quickly caused Joseph to be shaved and redressed and bathed and come before Pharaoh. Pharaoh told him the dream, and Joseph said, in effect, here's what God is telling you. There's going to be 7 years of real good harvest. And then there's going to be 7 years of bad harvest. So that what you need to do is prepare for the 7 good years to store the grain in storehouses that you might be able to provide when the 7 bad years come along. And then he said, when this happens, you need to have someone appointed who can take care of these matters for you. Well, that was pleasing to Pharaoh. It sounded reasonable. And, of course, the whole story in detail I haven't mentioned to you. And so he said to Joseph, who can I find better than you who are able to interpret this for me? So he put Joseph over the entire realm, everything except in the throne itself. So Pharaoh was the only one over Joseph. Everybody else was in subjection to Joseph. And the Bible tells us that as Pharaoh went in his chariot, Joseph's chariot was right behind him. And this went on for 7 years. We find now that Joseph is 37 years old. He left when he was 17. 20 years have passed. He's been away, not hearing from his family, not knowing anything about his family. The family didn't know where he was. Here's a man who has suffered. He was lied on. He was sold into slavery. He was lied on again. He put in prison. And all of a sudden, though, things begin to change and begin to turn. And that's what it is with God many, many times. We have a burden. We have to suffer somewhat. We learn through experience and through patience. But in time, God will pick us up. God blesses us and cares for us and puts us in a position, as you'll see in a moment, that we need to be in. So sure enough, there was a famine throughout the entire world. The world was an awful situation. But for 7 years, Egypt had prepared for this abundant harvest. And when the 7 bad years came, way back over there in Canaan land, where are the brothers and the sister and the family of Jacob, Joseph's parents? And they also begin to hurt now because there's no harvest there either. And so they send down to Egypt to get food for themselves. And if you would look for a moment, why is this important? Why do we mention this story? We could talk about other stories that we're not going to talk about, but this one we do because it points out the fact that God throughout the ages has over and over and over again touched and blessed and cared for his children, even though they may have sinned in the past. When they return and repent, He blesses them. Because you see, from before the world began, God said, I'll send my son through Abraham's line. If those 70 people over in Canaan had starved to death, God could not have kept his promise. If those people to whom the Messiah was going to come died because of famine, then God would have been mistaken. And he would not be God because he made a mistake. And so God had to allow them to live. And that's the reason all this is going on. That's the reason they have that famine. That's the reason they have this bountiful harvest to start with. Is because God sees fit through this means to save his people. So sure enough, they come down. They find that there's plenty there. They find that their long-lost brother and their long-lost son is there now, the number two man, highest in all the entire world, except for Pharaoh. And, of course, he blesses and cares for them. Now, they sold him to slavery, and they did what should not have been done. But the point is, we have also an attitude here that you and I need to look at very, very carefully. In Genesis chapter 49, just before he dies, Jacob, this is the old patriarch now, calls his sons before him. And he tells them that what you have done was wrong, but nonetheless, here's what's going to happen to all of your sons. In verse 8, he says to Judah, who was the one that is to carry on this line of descent, he says, Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. The father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey. My son, thou art gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lamb and as an old lamb. Who shall rouse him up? The scepter, this is a sign of authority. That a king or a pharaoh hold his hand, a staff, that he has a symbol of his power on. He says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Binding his foal unto the vine, and the ass's colt unto the choice vine, he washeth his garment in wine, his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red and white wine, and his teeth white with milk. So here we have a prediction that later on in the New Testament we find comes true in the coming of Jesus Christ. So in that line I saw you, showed you a few months ago on the screen, we have those 12 sons outlined. Joseph is the key now through which this happens, but Jacob is the son, the brother, through whom the line of descent is going to come. So here Jacob says, Judah, you're the one through whom this line is going to continue on, and we trace it. If you turn to Matthew chapter 1, Luke chapter 3, we find that Judah is the very one through whom the Messiah came eventually in the New Testament. This gives us a beautiful, beautiful picture of the prediction of the coming of the Messiah and what God had in mind. And then as we turn to the 50th chapter, let me see what verse I want to read here. Verse 15 of the last chapter. When Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead, they said, Joseph will peradventure hate us and will certainly requite us all the evil which we did unto him. They remember now what took place many, many, many years ago when they sold their brother into slavery. And they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, thy father did command before he died, saying, so shall ye say unto Joseph, forgive, I pray thee now, the trespass of thy brethren and their sin. For they did unto thee evil, and now we pray thee, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of thy father. And Joseph wept when they spake unto him. And his brethren also went and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we be thy servants. He's the number two man in power in the entire world now. And they are before him as the ones who sold him into slavery. They're guilty and they know it. And they're feeling the blunt of their sin. Sin has that effect. It caused us to feel so evil and so harmful and so destitute until we correct it. But look at the attitude of Joseph. Joseph said unto them, fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, ye thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring to pass as it is this day. And notice, to save much people alive. So God, through Joseph now, is saving the Israelites so that the line will continue on and Christ can come. Now therefore, fear ye not, I will nourish you and your little ones. He comforted them and spake kindly unto them. Then Joseph remained there in Egypt, and the others did too until he died. His body was put in a coffin and stayed there for another 215 years until they left the land of Egypt and went toward the promised land. The Bible has beautiful stories such as this throughout it. And certainly we ought to understand that God has not forgotten us. He gives us beautiful instructions. And as he does so, we are blessed beyond measure by the provision we see in his word. As we read on then, we notice that they go through this, they are there as captives, as slaves, because they had grown such a large number that the Egyptians were afraid now that it had become so large they can join our enemies when they have a war and they'll defeat us because of that large number. So let's make taskmasters over them to the point at which we'll subdue them, and that didn't work. The reason it didn't work is because the Israelites had children after children after children that grew and prospered. We read later on they had 600,000 men. Started with 70, now they have 600,000 men, the Bible tells us. Pharaoh had a reason to worry about them. And so Pharaoh issued a decree that all the male children, when they are born, will be cast into the river. Get rid of the male children. Leave the females alive, but get rid of the male children. Well, no doubt many of them did that, but there was a father and mother of a little baby that was born. He'd also had a brother before him whose name was Aaron, and a sister before that whose name was Miriam. But now this third child in this family was subject to being cast to the river. Of course, the mother doesn't want to do that. And so the mother tried to do what she could to save her little child. Last resort, she put him in a little ark, a little basket, a little box to float on the river. And she put him in the river, and I wonder what she felt like. I wonder how sad she might have been, how hard it must have been for her to see a little child put in the river, perhaps never see him again. Crocodile could eat him there, crocodile's there. He could have been swamped by water and drowned, but that's all she knew to do. But as God still will see fit to bless his people, God allowed Pharaoh's daughter to go down to the water's edge at this time to bathe, and they found this little child in this little ark, alive and well. And so she took him for her own. Little Israelite child. He's the very one they should have killed. He's the very one Pharaoh was after, but he didn't know that. God allowed Pharaoh's daughter to raise him in her family, in her house, as Pharaoh's grandson, in effect. In the meantime, when she took the little child out of the water, and of course they were looking at the child and wondering about the child, Joseph's little sister ran down. And she said to Pharaoh's daughter, do you want me to go and get one of the Israelite maids to take care of this child? And that pleased the Pharaoh's daughter exactly. And so, of course, what would happen, except Miriam went to get her own mother, who was Moses' own mother. She brought him down. Moses was reared then in the house of Pharaoh with all the pleasure and the joy and the money and all the treasures of Egypt at his disposal because he was a grandson of Pharaoh, but also reared by his own mother who taught him the truth, taught him of God and of his faithfulness as an Israelite. And the Bible tells us he grew and prospered. And so finally, there one day was an Egyptian who was mistreating an Israelite. Moses saw him and he killed the Egyptian, buried him. But there were some who saw that happen. He didn't know it. He didn't realize that anyone had seen him, but they did. Because the next day, the two Israelites who were fighting among themselves, and Moses tried to interfere. And one of them said, you're going to kill us like you did that Egyptian yesterday? And of course, he knew then that it was found. He knew then he'd been seen. And so Moses realized what he'd done. He had to flee. He did flee for 40 years southeast of Egypt in a place called Midian. And there he lived for a long, long time. He was 40 years old when he left Egypt. He lived in Midian for 40 years. He was 80 years old. At 80 years old, God allowed him, which was keeping the sheep of his father-in-law, to see a burning bush. Now, this burning bush was one that's unusual. You've never seen a burning bush that didn't burn up. All the bushes you've seen burn are consumed. This one wasn't. And so he went aside to take a better look at that. When he did, a voice told him, take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. God was using that bush to attract his attention and to tell Moses, it's time for my people to leave. You see, what had happened is that God allowed Israel to go into their slavery for 215 years. 430 years after the promise to Abraham. Now, the reason God did that is because, as Genesis tells us, the wickedness of the Amorites is not yet full. So the land of promise, the promised land that they were to inherit, was soon inhabited by those who are not yet wicked enough to be destroyed. God doesn't destroy righteous people. He knew they would become very, very unrighteous, and so he prepared for the Israelites to be spared and set aside under the Amorites, became so weak it's time now to get rid of them. So when this happened, it was time for them to leave. So Moses was called to go back to Egypt and to lead the people away from their bondage. Moses was speaking to God about this, and he didn't want to go. He said, again in effect, I'm not good at speech. I'm not the one who can go get someone else. And God said, who made your mouth in the first place? And God always answers us that way. We say, I can't. He said, you can. I know you can because I made you, and I know what you made. I know what you can do. And so Moses was convinced. He would take his brother as a spokesman. They went back to Pharaoh. And after the consequence of 11 miracles that took place, Pharaoh not only let them go, he thrust them out of the land of Egypt. And they went toward the Red Sea, crossed the Red Sea into the Sinai Peninsula. And there, remember, the children of Israel going now toward Mount Sinai, where they're given the Ten Commandment law. Moses now is 80 years old. It took them 50 days to leave the land of Egypt and drive Mount Sinai, and that's where God gave the law. The law of Moses, the Ten Commandment law, on two tables of stone. I wish I could go on. You're listening very, very well. I just love talk for another hour and a half, but you couldn't stand it, so I won't. If you will, come back tomorrow night. We'll find out something about the law of Moses and continue from there to bring our thoughts on down to eventually Jesus Christ and how that we have should have the respect and the love and the care of receiving Him as our Savior, which is God's intent from since before the world began. I don't know all the answers, of course, but if there's some things that you'd like to talk about and discuss, we'd be more than happy to do that as we continue our thought and try to bring to a satisfactory conclusion what the Bible says about you and me and our responsibility to God. As we stand to sing this final song of praise tonight, if there might be some way we can aid you spiritually, would you let your wish be known?